Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 24th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's start by looking at the weather. For today, isolated storms are possible with a southerly wind 10 to 20 miles per hour, high 85, low 67. Saturday, morning storms likely with a southerly wind at 15 to 25 miles per hour, high 86, low 61. On Sunday, partly sunny, breezy, with a northwesterly wind at 15 to 25 miles per hour, a high of 76, a low of 55. On Monday, mostly sunny, a southwesterly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour, a high of 78, and a low of 57. Today's top weather story is from meteorologist Jan Ryherd. Rain has been minimal this month, and the U.S. Drought Monitor is reflecting the lack of precipitation. Following the trend that began last week, areas of abnormality dry conditions have expanded in eastern Iowa, now covering areas along and south of Highway 30 and north of Highway 34, plus along the Mississippi River up to Dubuque County. With very limited rainfall in the forecast, this expansion is likely to continue. June is typically our wettest month, averaging 5.56 inches of rain, so we need an inch or more of rain every week just to keep pace. Our last measurable precipitation in Cedar Rapids was only 0.05 inches on June 15th, and in the last 2 weeks, we've only recorded 0.25 inches, with 2.27 inches this month total. And that's today's top weather story from meteorologist Jan Ryherd. On today's front page is a story written by Isabella Zaluska called Radically Changed. Dateline, Iowa City. Lance Corporal Gabe Hefner has been a fighter throughout his recovery after the Marine was shot in a bizarre incident last year while driving along an Iowa City street. His father, Niall, told the Gazette this week that Gabe has maintained a good attitude, his sense of humor, and his kindness during this recovery, something the family is grateful for. Gabe had been working hard. His walking and speech have improved in the months following the incident, but there's still a long way to go. Every part of Gabe's life has been affected, and his father said nothing is easy for him anymore. Niall said, adding how Gabe continues to work on his mobility, short-term memory, and movement in his left arm, it's just really radically changed his life and ours. We celebrate all of the life that he has, but we also mourn the life that he lost and that he may never get back. It's a balancing of the good and the bad, but just trying to be resilient and continue to improve and stay positive. Niall shared the journey Gabe and the rest of the Hefner family have been on during the victim's impact statement Thursday morning at the Johnson County Courthouse. Last October, the 20-year-old Marine was shot in the head while driving on Highway 6 near Sycamore Street. Police said the round was fired by a man who was shooting a pellet gun at a squirrel in his yard but missed and hit Gabe instead. Gabe crashed his car after being shot and was taken to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, where his family said he was, quote, fighting for his life. Gabe is the oldest of three children. He was in town visiting his grandparents when he was injured. The Hefners moved to Missouri 8 years after Gabe was born in Iowa City. Gabe spent about a month at UIHC before being transported on November 10, 2021, to the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab in Chicago, a nationally ranked physical medicine and rehabilitation research hospital. Gabe was there for just over 4 months and, in late March, returned home to the St. Louis area where he continues his recovery. Niall said Thursday, "We trust that God is writing a special story for Gabe, that Gabe will live in a full and abundant life, and he will not be defeated by this, but he will have victory over this injury, as well as love, joy, peace, and purpose." 70-year-old Philip Olson of Iowa City was sentenced Thursday to pay the maximum fine of $855 for violating city code by discharging a pellet gun within city limits, plus a $128.25 crime services surcharge and court costs. The total amount due is $1,043.25, according to court records. The city's ordinance does not include a jail time penalty. Olson pleaded guilty to the city code violation on April 27th and apologized for the, quote, horrible tragedy. He bought the air rifle to hunt squirrels in his yard to prevent them from messing with his property. Olson said he checked the city's website and found it was illegal to shoot a squirrel within city limits, but bought the air rifle anyway. Olson said, "I put my interest above the law. This is the worst decision I've ever made. I'll regret it for the rest of my life." Iowa City Police previously said that 3 days after the shooting, Olson came to the department to say he had heard about the incident and, quote, admitted to shooting from inside his house at the squirrel and missing at that time. Police said Olson fired a .22 caliber air rifle from his home adjacent to Highway 6. The air rifle was loaded with a metal pellet. Olson shot and killed 38 squirrels between September 17th and October 16th, 2021. Johnson County Magistrate Karen Egerton said that each shot put people, like Gabe, at risk. Egerton said it was concerning that Olson knew this was illegal and did it anyway in a residential area. Egerton said, "Your behavior, while not deemed reckless by the charge that you have, it was just a complete disregard for where you are, what you're doing, what's around you, and the life of these animals, and, in fact, the complete destruction of this man's family and his life and his future as a Marine." Johnson County Attorney Janet Linus previously told the Gazette she wanted to charge Olson with reckless use of a firearm, but a loophole in the law prevented the more serious charge. An air rifle or similar gun is not considered a firearm or dangerous weapon in Iowa, according to Linus. Olson also faced 4 violations from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. He paid the fines, which ended up totaling $450 last November, according to court records. Since returning to Missouri, Gabe has enjoyed spending time with family and friends, going to the movies, and getting out of the house, his father told the Gazette. He has 5 days of therapy during the week to get physical, occupational, speech, and recreational therapy. Niall said there's some older folks there that love talking to him. There's a former Marine who's there, and he loves talking to Gabe about the Marines. His father said Gabe is making good progress, but does need round-the-clock care and can't be left alone. Gabe's strength has improved, as has his walking. He needs to be monitored while walking, but his father said Gabe is walking well. Niall said he likes to get up and move around and loves to help make dinner, clean up. He's just very helpful and wants to be an active part of the family. The Heefner family is encouraged by Gabe's progress, but Niall said there's still a long way to go for his memory and his left hand and just his mobility. Tasks like brushing his teeth and eating are more difficult. The overall focus is for Gabe to continue getting stronger, but there's a special focus on his left arm and hand. Gabe also is working on strategies to improve his short-term memory. He has started to ask questions about what happened to him, why he can't remember certain details, and why he feels different. The conversations have been tough, Niall said, but they have told Gabe about the incident and his time at UIHC and the Ability Lab. Because of the challenges to his short-term memory, Gabe asks about what happened multiple times, but is now starting to fill in some of the details when he hears the story. Gabe's mom, Cody, who has been posting updates online during his recovery, stayed with Gabe for 5 months while he was in the Chicago facility. Niall would visit on the weekends, and they would try to trade places while also caring for their other 2 children. Gabe's grandparents, Shirley and Jim Heefner of Iowa City, have also been a big help, Niall said. Shirley, who is a retired nurse, helped take care of Gabe when he first returned to Missouri. The family also is grateful for the support, messages, gifts, and all that they've received from the community and others. Niall said, "We're all healing from this and will continue to be healing and just adjusting to a new way of life with him, but would have it no other way because he could have very easily died that day. Here's a story from the Iowa Today page written by Hannah Pinsky of the Gazette. CR couple wins Lucky for Life lottery prize. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. A Cedar Rapids couple won the Lucky for Life lottery prize of $25,000 a year for life. Chuck and Sherry Thomas are Iowa's 13th winners in the game, and Chuck Thomas said their good fortune was a result of a happy accident. Chuck Thomas originally bought a Lucky for Life ticket for what he thought was the November 4th, 2021 drawing, not realizing the game had switched to daily instead of twice weekly drawings. When he learned the ticket was for November 3rd, he bought a second ticket for November 4th, which was the winner, according to an Iowa Lottery news release. He bought the ticket at a Casey's store at 641 Edgewood Road Northwest in Cedar Rapids. The Thomases waited to claim their prize until they had a plan in place and chose to receive a lump sum payment of $390,000. While the couple said they were considering buying a hot tub, they plan to save and invest most of their winnings for their retirement. Lucky for Life is a $2 game with daily drawings. The minimum guaranteed payout for the top two prize levels is 20 years, and there is a lump sum option for those who prefer that. Also from the Iowa Today page is a story written by Michaela Ram. $9.3 million grant will fund stroke and heart programs in Iowa. Michaela says a national philanthropy organization has awarded the state $9.3 million to improve stroke care for Iowans and to launch a public health workforce initiative in rural parts of Iowa. The grants from the Leona M. and Harry B. Helmsley Charitable Trust was announced by the American Heart Association during a Thursday news conference at the Iowa State Capitol. The first $6.3 million grant will help fund the statewide American Heart Association initiative, which overall totals $7.5 million, called Mission Lifeline Stroke. First launched in 2010, the project aims to identify issues that may slow care for heart attack and stroke patients. The money will pay for public service campaigns and improve coordination between emergency medical services and stroke centers. A statewide data system will monitor patient care and long-term stroke outcomes, according to a news release from the American Heart Association. The Mission Lifeline Stroke Initiative will help us better coordinate stroke care from the time of onset to treatment, said Dr. Enrique Lira, the co-chair of the Iowa Stroke Task Force and head of the University of Iowa Healthcare Comprehensive Stroke Center. Lira said, "Stroke treatment is time-sensitive, so getting patients the proper treatment faster is crucial. This investment is going to be particularly impactful in decreasing the unacceptable disparity in stroke care that we are currently experiencing in rural states like Iowa." In 2015, the Helmsley Charitable Trust granted the state $4.6 million to launch the Mission Lifeline Project. At the time, the initiative was focused on cases of ST segment evaluation myocardial infarction, or STEMI, which is the most serious type of heart attack. The Helmsley Charitable Trust also is providing $3 million to the American Heart Association to launch HeartCore in three states, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wyoming. The program aims to place 100 public health workers in counties that rank the lowest in health during the 3 years of the Public Health AmeriCorps program. The goal is to implement systems that reduce cardiovascular risks and outcomes for rural residents. From the Top Stories page is a story written by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette. Lawyer wins deal for man killed by police. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. A Cedar Rapids lawyer has secured a $5 million settlement, possibly the largest in the state for a wrongful death and civil rights lawsuit, for a 27-year-old man who was fatally shot nearly 5 years ago by a Burlington police officer. Altavisi Williams, the mother of Marquis Jones, who was shot 8 times and killed by Burlington officer Chris Shiprez, pursued the lawsuit in May of 2019 when she felt she wasn't getting the complete story from the police of what happened on October 1, 2017 during a traffic stop. That comes, according to a statement Thursday from Dave O'Brien, the Cedar Rapids lawyer who represented Williams. A video released to O'Brien's office during the discovery phase of the case revealed she was right to be suspicious. Jones ran from officers and was told to drop his gun, which he did, but Chip Rez continued to fire. The video from Chip Rez's body camera showed him firing the eighth shot. Then officers at the scene said Jones's gun was not with him when he fell to the ground, but had been dropped before the final shot. In this statement, O'Brien said the evidence showed Jones followed an order to drop his gun when he was told to by Chip Rez about 50 yards and several moments before Chip Rez fired the fatal shot. O'Brien noted that about 1 in 12 Iowans owns a gun, and it's important to know that, quote, "When we follow police officers' orders, dropping a weapon when told to, Iowans shouldn't fear being shot anyway." Williams is happy to know the fight for justice for her son's death is over as she and her grandchildren await final court action. In a statement, Williams said, "I'm glad that we've gotten to the settlement phase. At this point, I will just be patient and continue to do what I have been. I will trust Dave and follow his lead while we wait for everything to actually finish up in the courts." O'Brien said this is an important case, and the settlement agreement confirms it. O'Brien said, "I'm not aware of a settlement larger than this in the state of Iowa for a wrongful death civil rights claim. We believe the city's agreement to settle for their policy limits shows that they understand that the shooting and killing of unarmed people in Burlington needs to stop." Last year, the city of Cedar Rapids paid an $8 million settlement to Jerime Mitchell, who claimed excessive force was used by a former officer, Lucas Jones, during a traffic stop in 2016. Mitchell survived, but remains paralyzed today. O'Brien said he believes the case could have been worth much more had it gone to trial in January, but the decision was made to settle so Burlington taxpayers, quote, "wouldn't be held financially liable for the mistakes of the city's police force." In March, the U.S. 8th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Chip Rez wasn't entitled to qualified immunity. The court denied him immunity due to autopsy results, body cameras footage, and inconsistent police reports that didn't support his version of events. Chip Rez remains with the Burlington Police Department, O'Brien's office confirmed on Thursday. In the statement, O'Brien thanked Williams and Jones's children for the honor and privilege of representing them. He also thanked Nick Rowley and Haytham Farage of Trial Lawyers for Justice, a national law firm, noting that Rowley's track record against defendants who have participated in egregious conduct that leads to death. Let's move on to the inside page for today's Gazette editorial, which is headlined, "A Court Precedent Revoked." The editorial says, "Iowa's Supreme Court ruled last week that the state constitution protects no fundamental right to an abortion. It's a deeply disappointing ruling that, coupled with the U.S. Supreme Court's expected ruling overturning Roe v. Wade, casts a dark cloud over reproductive rights and personal freedoms held dearly by so many Iowans and Americans." It was just 4 years ago, in 2018, that a differently configured Iowa Supreme Court ruled that access to abortion services is a fundamental right. The latest ruling means future abortion restrictions approved by the legislature will face a less rigorous constitutional test. What that test will be remains to be seen, given the U.S. Supreme Court's expected ruling and continuing litigation in the Iowa case, Planned Parenthood v. Reynolds, concerning a 24-hour waiting period before having an abortion. "We believe the 2018 ruling should have been upheld, despite the fact that Governor Kim Reynolds in recent years has chosen new justices that changed the court's membership and political composition. This rather sudden change in a significant portion of our court's composition is exactly the sort of situation that challenges so many of the values that stare decisis, which is judicial review, promotes concerning stability in the law, judicial restraint, and the public's faith in the judiciary and the legitimacy of judicial review. That was Chief Justice Susan Christensen who said that, arguing against overturning the precedent, wrote in a separate opinion. We agree. Pulling the rug out from under Iowans who value this fundamental right after just 4 years surely will shake confidence in the court to be a fair arbiter for questions of constitutional equity. Tossing important precedents regarding important issues such as civil rights and individual liberties creates a court that looks more like a legislature than a judicial branch steered by the policies of the politics of the moment. Whether they be 4 years old or 50 years old, yanking away the roots of our legal protections leaves a hole to be filled by political overreach, partisan divisions, and misguided legislation. We'd like to urge the Republican-controlled legislature and the governor, should they be returned to power next year, to not see this ruling as a green light for placing heavy, burdensome restrictions on reproductive freedom. But knowing their track record, it's hardly worth the breath. Government has no business injecting itself into deeply personal decisions between Iowans and their health care providers. Abortions are sought for many reasons, and it's irresponsible for politicians to push for restrictions that make these procedures more difficult to obtain and less safe. The court has spoken. Now voters have some serious choices to be made in November. And that's today's Cedar Rapids Gazette editorial. Here's a guest editorial written by Timothy Walsh of Coralville that says, Migration, Work, Faith Shape Iowa. Timothy says, don't judge a book by its cover. Oh, and don't judge a book by its title. That second admonition certainly applies to Meatpacking America, a new book published by the University of North Carolina Press. Don't misunderstand. This important new book does tell us about an industry vital to Iowa's economy. Many aspects of meatpacking are woven throughout the text. But the heart of Meatpacking America is best captured in its subtitle, How Migration, Work, and Faith Unite and Divide the Heartland. It underscores the power and importance of cultural diversity in our state. Author Christy Nabhan Warren said, the elements that drive this story of disparate native-born Iowans and newer arrivals are the conjoined passions of religious faith and desire to work hard for one's children and grandchildren in order to achieve a slice of heaven on earth. A desire to find a haven in Iowa has been a goal of Iowans from the earliest days of settlement. That goal of heaven on earth was embraced by the Europeans who settled our farms and cities in the 19th century, as well as by recent newcomers from Central America, Southeast Asia, and Africa. A professor of religious studies at the University of Iowa, Nabhan Warren, interviewed over 100 Iowans of many faiths and cultural origins. Most were Catholics, but other Christians and Muslims also were included. The interviews were friendly and transparent, a sincere effort to learn more about people who risked so much for sanctuary in the heartland. Nabhan Warren begins with the land, the farm so lovingly maintained by the descendants of the Irish and German Catholics. She highlights the importance of religious faith and how it extends to welcoming and working with the newest immigrants. For both groups, she writes, work takes on sacred meanings. Much of the book focuses on how immigrant families express their faith and cultural traditions in towns such as Columbus Junction and West Liberty. Guiding many of them along the way are Catholic priests and others who embrace the politics of inclusion. The work of these priests extends to the processing plants where their parishioners work each day. Some of these priests have deep ethnic roots, others have Anglo blood and Latino hearts. Nabhan Warren also takes us into the processing plants and explains the complex work done by these people of faith. Descriptive chapters remind us of the sacrifices that are made each day to put meat on our tables. Communication and cultural tradition are central elements in the packing plant. In addition to chaplains, plant managers value the translators who keep the production lines moving. Contrary to the popular notion of heartless managers, Nabhan Warren shows that there are many Anglo supervisors who care deeply about the welfare of their employees. She said, Meatpacking America will be of interest to anyone who wants to know how the newest Iowans have come to define themselves in their new land. Timothy Walsh is a volunteer at the Iowa City Center of the State Historical Society of Iowa and a member of the Iowa State Historical Records Advisory Board. We have one community letter today, and it's from Jackie Martin of Mount Vernon, who says, "Thank you for Todd Dorman's column in the Gazette on June 19th regarding the threat to Iowa's public schools from Kim Reynolds and the GOP agenda to take money from public education and use it to fund attendance at private schools. Quality public education is a requirement for a working democracy. Our state and our country cannot function without informed voters. Also, thriving public schools are the backbone of rural Iowa towns. What will happen to our small towns when their already hard-up schools are forced to close because they have lost funds to private school vouchers? Converting empty school buildings to apartments does not bring the community together on Friday nights, does not bring the community out for high school theater and music. We Iowans, neighbors, parents, grandparents, must fight for our public schools. The best way to do that is at the ballot box. That is one reason I am voting for Jessica Wiskus in Senate District 42. Another reason is that I know she will stand firm against using eminent domain to take land for private profit. Let's all study the issues and vote for the candidates who are ready to support the farmers and the people who want quality public schools for their kids in their towns." That's a community letter today from Jackie Martin of Mount Vernon. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 24th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we have the shorter other notices. From Anamosa, Ronald E. McBride, age 81, died Thursday, June 23rd. Assisting the family will be the Getch Funeral Home of Anamosa. From Decorah, Benjamin Davis Lang, age 81, died Friday, January 28th. The Helms Funeral Home in Decorah is in charge of those arrangements. Also from Decorah, Robert Ludeking, age 67, died Wednesday, June 22nd. The Helms Funeral Home of Decorah will assist the family. From Dorchester, Karen S. Breshnahan, age 54, died Wednesday, June 22nd. Assisting the family will be the Martin Grau Funeral Home of Waukon. Out of Loudoun, Merlin Kruckenberg, age 94, died Thursday, June 23rd. Assisting the family will be the Chapman Funeral Home of Clarence. Also from Loudoun, Dick Menzing, age 73, died Wednesday, June 22nd. Also, the Chapman Funeral Home of Clarence will be in charge of those arrangements. From Marion, Wesley Follansby, age 95, died Wednesday, June 22nd. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is in charge of those arrangements. Also from Marion, Kenneth Ray Gilmore, age 85, died Tuesday, June 21st. Again, the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion will be in charge of those arrangements. Also from Marion, Denise Sue Wackle, age 66, died Wednesday, June 22nd. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion will assist the family. From Olwine, Darrell A. Lau, age 83, died Wednesday, June 22nd. The Jameson Schmidt Funeral Home of Olwine is in charge of those arrangements. And from Solon, Betty Jane Croy, age 90, died Wednesday, June 22nd. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center of Solon will be in charge of those arrangements. Now to the longer, more detailed funeral announcements. Carl Robert Green, age 67 of Cedar Rapids, passed away surrounded by family and friends on Tuesday, June 21st at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Family and friends will gather for a visitation from 3 till 6 o'clock Sunday night at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids. The service at the funeral home in Ehrman at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery will be private for the family. Memorials are suggested to the Salvation Army. From Cedar Rapids, there is a funeral notice here for a person who only gives their first name. The name is Vitaly. Funeral services for Vitaly will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday at the Papish Kuba Funeral Home East at 1228 2nd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids, followed by burial at Oak Hill Cemetery. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home. Elizabeth J. Rice, age 103, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Wednesday, June 22nd, at West Ridge Care Center in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, June 27th, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior, beginning at 10 a.m. at the chapel. Burial will follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorials are to be sent to the Hospice of Mercy in Elizabeth's honor. Artist Arlene Blankenhorn, age 100, of Washington, Iowa, died Wednesday, June 22nd, at the Halkyon House in Washington. Celebration of life services will be held at 11 o'clock Monday morning at the Jones and Eden Funeral Home, with Pastor Jason Collier officiating. The family will be present to receive friends from 10 to 11 o'clock Monday morning at the funeral home. Interment will take place at the Elm Grove Cemetery in Washington. Memorials have been established to the United Methodist Church. Also, Paul D. Punk Sheets, age 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Wednesday, June 22nd, at the Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Visitation will be held from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, June 29th, at Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City. Funeral services will follow at 10:30 a.m. Interment will be at St. Peter's Cemetery in Cosgrove. Memorials may be made to the Hospice House of Mercy. Larry Joe Davis, age 88, of Hiawatha, died Monday, June 20th, at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. At Larry's request, there will be no visitation or service. Family and friends will celebrate Larry and Sally's life at a later date. Interment will be in the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Richard Gene Fisher, age 90, of Cedar Rapids, died Tuesday, June 21st. Celebration of life services will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, June 29th. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest will hold military rites to be conducted. Private family interment will be at a later date in Czech National Cemetery. Coletta Lucille Hoy Eisenhofer, age 95, of Iowa City, passed away on Sunday, May 29th, at the Solon Care Center. A memorial mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. with gathering time from 10 to 10:30, Wednesday, June 29th, at St. Patrick Church in Iowa City. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, June 28th, at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. Coletta will be laid to rest following mass at St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City. Memorials may be directed to the Iowa City Public Library or the Alzheimer's Association Greater Iowa Chapter. And Pamela S. Vagel, age 61, of Fairfax, died Tuesday, June 21st. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, June 27th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will take place at 10:30 Tuesday, June 28th, at the funeral home. Turning to the sports page, there's a story written by Mike Halas of the Gazette. Headline, Just Plain Hawkeye History. Iowa's Keegan Murray was selected by the Sacramento Kings with the fourth pick in last night's NBA draft. Murray is from Cedar Rapids Prairie and became the highest NBA draft pick ever from Iowa. Fred Brown went sixth in 1971. Murray is the Hawkeyes' first top 10 pick since Ronnie Lester in 1980. Murray was a consensus All-America forward this year after averaging 23.5 points, 8.7 rebounds, 1.9 block shots, and 1.3 steals per game. He made 39.8% of his three-point tries. The first three picks were Duke forward Paolo Banchero to Orlando, Gonzaga forward Chet Holmgren to Oklahoma City, and Auburn forward Jabari Smith to Houston. In a related story on the sports page is one written by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette. Prairie crowd cheers on favorite son. Dateline Cedar Rapids. Jeremy Rickardson popped in on to visit Keegan Murray and his family Monday afternoon at their West Side Cedar Rapids home. He was struck by what he saw in a good way. the Cedar Rapids Prairie head boys basketball coach said. I knew they were leaving for New York on Tuesday. Keegan sitting at the kitchen table giving his sister some crap. In my mind, I was like, on Thursday night, your name is going to be broadcast worldwide. On a Monday afternoon, you're sitting here in Cedar Rapids. Everyone applauded loudly when Murray, his mom, Michelle, and dad, Kenyon, were introduced at the draft last night as the family walked from a platform runway to their seats at Barclays Center in Brooklyn. They exploded in gleeful jubilation when Murray's name was announced as a draft pick. John Randles, the longtime Prairie public address announcer who shouted Murray's name countless times after scoring a basket in his three-year varsity career with the Hawks, said, "This is so exciting. You can't ask for a better person than Keegan. Just a class act all around. Not just himself, but he's always been a good team member. It's just great to see." Max Lampe, a former teammate of Murray at Prairie, said, "This is surreal. I mean, I'm glad this is going on here to just applaud what Keegan has done this past decade, putting in work behind the scenes that no one has really seen to get to this moment. It's huge. I've been looking at this clock for the last 6 hours. I'm excited and ready to go." Like Rickardson, Lampe mentioned how Murray has remained humble as his game took off to the point where he became an All-American for the Hawkeyes and declared early for the draft. Murray has continued to keep in regular contact with his old high school buddies. Lampe said, "I reach out a few times a month. We text back and forth often. He's still the same kid. Nothing has changed. Still a down-to-earth dude. As I saw in an interview one time, he said he's going to sign his check and probably go buy groceries." That's a 21-year-old kid thinking about his life like that instead of all the parties he's going to have. Murray left some autographed memorabilia with Rickardson and Prairie Activities Director Rocky Bennett that was handed out to kids in attendance at the watch party. Prairie senior-to-be Tim Jones was too old to get any of that memorabilia, though he was okay with that. He's already been hooked up. Jones said, "I met him once at a game. Then they had an autograph thing here, and I got the autographs on a shirt. I'm going to hold on to that." Here's a state story from the Iowa Today page that is of local interest, written by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette. Iowa Legal Aid gets money to help derecho victims. Trish says Iowa Legal Aid will receive more than $1.4 million from the Legal Services Corporation to provide legal services to low-income people who are impacted by the August 2020 derecho. The nonprofit corporation, which pays for civil liberty aid for low-income people, also awarded an additional $34,000 to reimburse Iowa Legal Aid for services related to the derecho. The Iowa organization is one of 19 across the country receiving grants for natural disasters that happened in 2020 and 2021, according to a news release from the Legal Services Corporation. Congress included $40 million for the nonprofit in a $28.6 billion emergency supplemental appropriation attached to the September 2021 continuing resolution to fund the government in fiscal 2022. Nick Smithberg is executive director of Iowa Legal Aid and said Thursday they're grateful for the additional funding. The money, he said, will allow them to hire additional staff, paralegals and lawyers in the Cedar Rapids regional office and in Des Moines. They also will use the funding to engage more legal volunteers and conduct community building and outreach with Iowa's disaster response groups. Lawyers aren't the first thing people think about needing when a natural disaster strikes, but disasters bring many legal challenges. Smithberg said, many times people who have storm damage to their homes need help with a title so they can receive assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. They may need help replacing documents or with insurance claims and with contractor fraud or scams. Smithberg said he didn't have any statistics for the number of derecho cases legal aid has handled, but hopes to do that once additional staff is hired. The recovery process, he said, will continue for a long time. The last legal aid cases related to the 2008 historic flood weren't closed until 2015, he pointed out. Ronald S. Flagg, president of Legal Services Corporation, said in a statement, low-income people who confront civil legal issues in the wake of natural disasters face an uphill battle, and they shouldn't have to go it alone. We are grateful that Congress recognizes the need for legal assistance in these recovering communities and provided this funding that will help our neighbors repair and stay in their homes, obtain key identification documents, and apply for benefits, and so much more. From the living section, we have a story about COVID-19. It says, does the pandemic have you pangry? Dateline Mankato, Minnesota. Are we out of the woods with COVID-19? Have we reached the endemic stage? Should we adopt the mindset that the virus is just a part of our lives now and carry on as usual? Many people are walking around with more questions than answers as the new COVID variants emerge and case counts continue to fluctuate. Without a definitive answer as to what the next phase of the pandemic will look like, mental fatigue has set in for many during this COVID limbo, as has anxiety, depression, and persistent anger. Dr. Patrick Bigouet, who's a psychiatrist at the Mayo Clinic Health System in Mankato, Minnesota, says it's been well over 2 years since the start of the pandemic, and of course, people are frustrated and anxious. When COVID-19 case counts tick back up, people are naturally nervous about whether it's okay to go to a movie, send their child back to school, or the possibility of increased COVID-related public policies. The recurrent feelings of anxiety can be mentally fatiguing. Research has shown an increase in frustration, agitation, and anger throughout the course of the COVID-19 pandemic. Pandemic anger, or panger, is a real mental health concern many people are dealing with. Bigouet said, feeling these emotions is a perfectly natural response. However, we want to help people cope and respond in healthy ways. Yelling at others, dwelling on the situation, or shutting down can negatively affect one's health, work, and relationships. Here are some ideas that may help you respond more effectively to panger rather than simply reacting. For one, step back and observe. Take a deep breath and pay attention to what's happening in the moment without judging or evaluating your experience. Do you notice frustration and anger in your body, such as tightening of the chest, clenching of the jaw or fists, or feeling hot? You may notice an action urge or impulse, such as the urge to scream or run away. Simply slowing down and observing anger can make it seem less overwhelming and help create space between your anger and what you do next. Allow panger to be present. People often try to avoid or get rid of unpleasant internal experiences, including thoughts, emotions, and memories. And with anger, the tendency to avoid can result in various automatic reactions that aren't always helpful and can even increase anger over time. For example, lashing out at someone may make you feel better in the moment, but it doesn't often help in the long term and may even make you feel worse, such as feeling guilty for yelling at your children or a coworker. Listen to anger's message about what you value. Choosing to allow anger, along with associated thoughts, emotions, physical sensations, and urges, to be present without automatically trying to avoid or get rid of it, creates freedom and flexibility to choose effective and meaningful actions. Accepting anger is an active choice, not a passive resignation. It doesn't mean you're accepting the situation that may have led to anger, or that you're giving up on what you care about. It means you're choosing to put energy toward effective action rather than focusing solely on trying to control the uncontrollable. Also, choose effective action. Once you've slowed down to listen to the message anger is sending you, choose your next effective action. You may not be able to control what others say and do, or even what you think and feel, but you can control how you respond. Bigouet said, people will continue to have disagreements about social distancing and gathering, about public policies related to the pandemic, about work restrictions, and any number of other pandemic-related situations. There are many things out of our control during these uncertain times, and our feelings related to these experiences are natural and appropriate. We just want to make sure we're dealing with our emotions in healthy ways. Turning now to the Business 380 section, we have a story from the Gazette new Cedar Rapids Dunkin' to open sometime next year. The story says Eastern Iowa Food Service plans to open its 9th Dunkin' in the corridor sometime next year, said Clifford Reef, the CEO and president of Reef Oil. The Burlington-based Reef Oil owns Eastern Iowa Food Service, the franchise holder for the Dunkin' restaurants in the area. The new Cedar Rapids venue at 1st Avenue and 19th Street Northeast on the site of the former Western Fraternal Life Association building will boast a drive-up window on the second floor that will be accessed from behind the building, Reif told the Gazette on Thursday. The first floor will house its bakery and other offices, he said. Reif Oil owns the Western Fraternal building. Robert Peck of Design Dynamics, based in Cedar Rapids, is chief architect and, Reif says, has designed all our Dunkin' sites. Eastern Iowa Food Service franchises first Dunkin' in the corridor at 2905 Blair's Ferry Road Northeast, Cedar Rapids, opened in 2013. Western Fraternal Life Association, which is a Cedar Rapids-based not-for-profit financial services organization, approved a merger with the National Mutual Benefit, a Madison, Wisconsin life insurance society, in 2020. It closed its Cedar Rapids office in 2021. Quickstar, headquartered in La Crosse, Wisconsin, for a time had planned to open a convenience store at that 1st Avenue Northeast location, but met with neighborhood opposition. Also on the business page is a story with local implications. Jobless claims little changed. Applications for an unemployment insurance nationally last week have plateaued after a five-month high, suggesting tightness in the labor market may be starting to ease. Initial jobless claims decreased by 2,000 down to 229,000 in the week ended June 18th, U.S. Department of Labor data showed on Thursday. The previous week's figure was revised up slightly. The jobless claims four-week moving average, which is a measure that smooths out some of the volatility in the series, increased to 223,500, the highest since late January. While the labor market remains strong and unemployment low, there are some signs of softening. Several companies, including J.P. Morgan Chase and Coinbase Global, have announced layoffs in recent weeks. Meantime, recession fears among some observers are growing after the Federal Reserve raised interest rates by the most since 1994 and signaled further tightening in an effort to tame inflation. On an unadjusted basis, initial claims also fell slightly. Continuing claims for state benefits were also little changed at 1.32 million for the week ended June 11th. From the national page is a story that really has some local implications. Feds propose major overhaul of campus sex assault rules. The Biden administration proposed a dramatic overhaul of campus sexual assault rules Thursday, acting to expand protections for LGBTQ students, bolster the rights of victims, and widen colleges' responsibilities in addressing sexual misconduct. The proposal was announced on the 50th anniversary of the Title IX women's rights laws and is intended to replace a set of controversial rules issued during the Trump administration by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. President Joe Biden's Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said Title IX has been instrumental in fighting sexual assault and violence in education. He said, "As we celebrate the 50th anniversary of this landmark law, our proposed changes will allow us to continue that progress and ensure all our nation's students, no matter where they live, who they are, or whom they love, can learn, grow, and thrive in school." The proposal is almost certain to be challenged by conservatives and is expected to lead to new legal battles over the rights of transgender students in schools, especially in sports. It now faces a public feedback period before the Biden administration can finalize any changes, meaning the earliest that the policy is likely to take effect is next year. The step means a demand from victims' rights advocates who wanted the president to release new rules no later than the anniversary of Title IX, which outlaws discrimination based on sex in schools and colleges. Advocates say DeVos's rules have gone too far in protecting students accused of sexual misconduct at the expense of victims. As a presidential candidate, Biden had promised a quick end to DeVos's rules, saying they would shame and silence survivors. In announcing its proposal, Biden's Education Department said DeVos's rules weakened protections for survivors of sexual assault and diminished the promise of an education free from discrimination. For the first time, the rules would formally protect LGBTQ students under Title IX. Nothing in the 1972 law explicitly addresses the topic, but the new proposal would clarify that the law applies to discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. It would make clear that preventing someone from participating in school programs and activities consistent with their gender identity would cause harm in violation of Title IX. That's according to the department. More specific rules dealing with the rights of transgender students in school sports will be released later, the department said. Many of the proposed changes would mark a return to Obama-era rules that DeVos policy replaced. The definition of sexual harassment would be expanded to cover a wider range of misconduct. Schools would be required to address any misconduct that creates a hostile environment for students, even if the misconduct arises off campus. Most college employees would be required to notify campus officials if they learn of potential sex discrimination. In a victory for victims' rights advocates, the proposal would eliminate a rule requiring colleges to hold live hearings to judge sexual misconduct cases, one of the most divisive aspects of DeVos's policy. Live hearings would be allowed under the new policy, but colleagues could appoint a campus decision maker to evaluate evidence and assess students' credibility. If the proposal is finalized, it would mark the second rewrite of federal Title IX rules in 2 years. DeVos's rules were themselves intended to reverse Obama-era guidance. The Obama policy was embraced by advocates but led to hundreds of lawsuits from students who said their colleges failed to give them a fair process to defend themselves. Here is a somewhat local story from the Iowa Today page. It's actually written by Chad Drury of the Ottumwa Courier, which says, "Beauty school to close soon." Andrew Oswald could see the writing on the wall, but that didn't make the decision any easier. Oswald is the president of Iowa School of Beauty and announced on June 17th on Facebook that the Ottumwa campus will close August 27th, ending a run of over 50 years as a beauty school in the community. Though the campus wasn't always known as the Iowa School of Beauty, it served as a training ground for cosmetologists for years. He said Monday, "I wish I had an answer for why the trends have been in decline, but I don't think there's any specific reason. Enrollments have kind of worked inverse for the economy in the sense that, you know, during recessionary periods, people go back to school and think maybe it's time for a career change." Oswald said enrollments peaked around 2010, but enrollment at the Ottumwa campus has dropped considerably in the last decade. In 2012, the campus had 65 new students. Last year, it had only 16. He said, "You see it every year, and the majority of schools that are closing are in communities that have populations of less than 50,000, and there's less people just coming to school for cosmetology in general. You have to have new students to continue a revenue stream." Oswald has been at the Iowa School of Beauty since 2011. He went on to say, "The ones coming to school are typically going to a bigger community to receive their education. Schools are leaving small communities because they just can't turn a profit." With the closure of this Ottumwa campus, the Iowa School of Beauty will have campuses in Des Moines and Sioux City only. The school closed its campus in Marshalltown in 2018. He said, "As soon as we closed that one, then we really had to monitor the Ottumwa campus because we didn't want to get into a situation again where we put all our schools at risk to try to keep one going for as long as possible." Students currently enrolled in the campus, however, have a new option. Iowa School of Beauty has partnered with the American Hair Academy in Mount Pleasant to take on those students in what Oswald called a teach-out agreement. The American Hair Academy will take on those currently enrolled and accept all the students' transfer hours. Oswald said 5 students will be graduating later this year. He went on to say the transition is seamless because owner Lori Greiner has agreed to teach our students with no additional costs. There's no application fee, and they'll finish their cosmetology education at American Hair Academy. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 24th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.